Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be
happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Change Agent's Dilemma for Tuesday, May 17th, 2011. I'm your host, Heather Stagel, coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia, as I do once a month on Blog Talk Radio. This show is one of the many ways I help equip individuals to lead organizational change at Enclaria, LLC. The Change Agent's Dilemma is how to influence change without authority. And my goal with this show is to provide ideas and methodologies to help you do just that. Today, my guest is Garrett Gitchell, the founder of Vision to Work. He's here to share his approach to change, which involves creating positive pull towards an end state. Garrett is a high-level change management consultant to senior executives and their stakeholders. He helps organizations tackle large-scale transformational change by creating change entities to make the structural and procedural connections necessary for replicable and sustainable change. His end state back approach to change management creates an environment that connects people to business objectives in a positive way. He has a Master of Science in Human Resource and Organizational Development from the University of San Francisco and has consulted to over 70 organizations. Through his firm, Vision to Work, he helps design and implement organizational transformation. Garrett believes change is a given and is, in fact, something stakeholders will freely participate in when they see their connection to the bigger picture and when it makes sense at an individual level. Garrett, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Heather.
So let's start at the beginning, which for you is really the end. So describe for me what you mean by the end state. That's
well, whatever
terminology.
Yeah, and this is a term that probably I use, although I'm starting to see it more often now, would be the spot when the change is completed, when the transformation is done, when all the changes have taken place, and there's effectively a new status quo. So it would include people, culture, process, structure, change of behaviors, change of skills, change of talent maybe. There may be new people added, and there may be people that aren't left from the present when the end state arrives.
So how is that different, or is it different from, say, when people talk about a vision?
It's probably closer to a vision than, say, a future state. A lot of models use a future state, a present state, and then some sort of filling of the gap in between. End state is probably closer to vision, but I think what happens in organizations is they stop at the vision and they don't translate the vision into something that makes sense for stakeholders at an individual level. So that would be my extension in changing the name to end state to include, well, there's a vision, there's an idea, there's a dream of how this is going to be, but what would that actually look like, feel like, be like, and how would the organization be different as a result?
Okay, so you start at the end state, and then what's the process? What's the process you go through for change management using the end state?
Right, yeah. Early on, I get the leaders and the early stakeholders and the owners of the change to begin to define that end state and figure out exactly what that would look like, and then work back from the end state to the present to fill in the pieces. So the end state will include all of these different things that we come up with in the description, and we can take that list of the things that I'll have to have, and we can look at the present and say, how many of these things do we actually have? How much of the talent do we have that we need? Is the organization structured correctly? Are the processes in place that can help us get to that spot? Do we have the right people? Will the culture be completely different? Are there behavioral changes that will have to happen? And in a way, you could say that's gap filling, but it's from a completely different perspective. It's going to the hardware store to buy all the pieces to build the house.
With the house completed in mind.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the analogies I've used a few times with clients is the whole process of getting a building up. There's people that build, there's people that design, there's people that gather all the parts to put it together. There's people that are specific kinds of builders, and all that goes into the final end state, which is what the architect imagined the house would look like, translated into what made sense functionally and practically and usefully.
Okay. So with a house, though, if we're going with that metaphor, a house starts with an empty lot.
Yep.
Right? But an organization is already existing. It's not really an empty lot. So where does the present come in with this?
It stands as a perfect analogy, because there are times when you look at the house and you have to decide, do I knock it down to the lot and start from effectively scratch, minus having bought the land already, or do I take what I have here and remodel it to this end state vision that I have? And at that point with a house, you have to look at whether or not there'll be so many things that you have to do structurally and procedurally that it's too expensive to add on to what you have, and it's cheaper to knock it down. Now, it's hard to knock down an organization, but I think what ends up happening if you're taking a present forward approach rather than trying to figure out what this thing is at the end and then filling in the pieces, you'll tend to say, well, this room was pretty good. It worked pretty good. Let's keep this room. This part was pretty good. Let's keep this part. Well, there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with this. Let's keep this. And you quickly get away from deciding whether or not things apply to the place you're going, and it's more protecting status quo.
Okay. Well,
so
other
in a
change
sense,
management
you will
methodology.
Dismantle part of the present. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say other change management methodologies use this sense of urgency idea with the present. You're trying to move away from something. But it sounds like that doesn't really come into your approach.
Not in the same way that sense of urgency is used. That's originally a step of the Cotter approach, and it's to get people excited and moving forward and willing to participate. But what ends up happening is it's almost like chickens running around in circles, that it's false urgency. It's urgency because somebody wants something to happen, but the people that are there to make it happen don't necessarily agree with it. And in building an end state and having to be more positive and looking towards the goals, it's easier to show why it makes sense to participate. If each individual stakeholder has a role in this end state, they probably have a role in the process to get there, or they might need to build some things so that they have the skills and the talent and what's ever needed for this end state. So if you get a sense of urgency from this approach, it's because people want to participate. It's an urgency to, well, I want to make sure I'm ready for this spot. I realize that I do have no choice. It is moving in that direction, and I want to be part of it. And they've illustrated and communicated to me that I will be a part of it. So I'm going to do what I need to participate and build myself to that spot. So it's less protecting, and it's more preparing and participating towards something.
So really going towards that intrinsic motivation, like giving people a sense of purpose around what their role is in the organization. Okay.
Yep. And there's a one word that's always used, inclusion. And what happens a lot of times with models is the inclusion is just asking someone or sometimes telling them to participate at a certain time. But the inclusion isn't a personal thing that ties into the person's talent or their ability to contribute or their actual genuine inclusion in this end state.
So more just inviting someone, but not really thinking of how they fit in.
And inviting them for a talent they have or a skill they have or a connection they have to this goal, which is an instant motivator.
Okay. Well, how does this approach deal with resistance to change?
It's pretty hard to get around resistance. I try to as much as possible, because I think most of the change approaches spend so much time assuming there'll be resistance that they almost get what they ask for. Mm-hmm. The more you bring that up, the more people resist a little bit more, and they get more attention by having resisted, and then the more that spreads. And then the more you call it out, the worse it gets, and it just ends up being a spiral from one person to the next. So it's
right,
not that
if the change is so great, why do you have to convince me to do it, right?
Exactly, yeah. So you're telling me that I'm going to resist, and I actually kind of wanted to participate, and now I'm changing my mind. So it will happen because change is difficult, and it may require things that people have to do while they're still doing their regular job. But the kind of resistance that most people think of that will stop change tends to go down to an individual, single level, sometimes one person. And sometimes the assumption before the change even starts is it'll be this person. We know exactly who it is. And 9 times out of 10, that resistance has a really strong basis in reality, and it tends to have less to do with the change itself and more to do with either historical things that have happened, like change in the past that didn't work, or the fact that these people that are resisting know that we don't really have the process to be able to do this. We don't have the structure to be able to do this. We really don't have the tools or the talent to be able to do this. I've seen this before. It's not going to work. And if the change process understands that and asks the right questions early on, probably from those people who they know will resist, to get some answers to be able to fill in those pieces that don't seem to be there, then the change will move forward smoother. People will participate more, and the resistance will be more discerning comments as opposed to genuine trying to stop the change resistance.
Okay, so I just totally forgot what I was going to say.
You know, one of the things I can
I had
add into that.
A question like 2 sentences back, and I lost it.
One of the things that happens that ties into that is that most change management is brought in too late, and most starting to pay attention to the change is too late in the process, and so you end up in firefighting mode, and there's no front loading of the change to make connections with people, especially the people who may resist later. When the process actually starts, if you have change management early on and you're looking towards a goal, you can start figuring out how to describe that goal. And in the process, you'll connect with stakeholders. You'll be able to go straight to those people you think might resist and get some information. And then later, when the train has left the station and things are moving full blast, you have these things to pull out to say, so-and-so contributed this and made this suggestion, and we adjusted our process, or we added to our structure, or we changed a couple of things to be able to address that. So now we're at that spot where, because we put those things in, this will be easier to do. And if you've done that, then you've started to build some trust with leadership, too, and trust with the individuals that are actually implementing the change process.
So your approach is really to make the end state, I almost said future state, to make the end state so compelling and involve so many people in creating what that end state is going to be, that it's so compelling that pretty much people won't resist because they were part of creating it. Is that true?
Yes. So that would actually, maybe compelling is a little too strong a word because it won't be compelling for everybody. But
sure.
But that's good because that's the same thing on the positive side that happens with the resistance. So you assume somebody's going to resist, and then you call it out, and they tend to resist a little bit more than they would have ordinarily, or they resist when they wouldn't have ordinarily. It works the same on the other side, although it's twice as hard. If something is positive and genuinely makes sense all the way down to the individual level, and that's been communicated, and there's trust, then people jump on board. Then people are willing to participate. But the step that's usually missing is having it make sense, having it connect at an individual level, and then having a thing that you can go to, a goal that you can reach towards, something that is compelling. And that's
so. Do you have to do any prep work around building trust? And it seems like the way you just described it, it seems like there's an environment in which this works well.
Yes. You can't really just create trust. You have to build trust. But in an environment where there wasn't trust, say there was a historical change event that didn't work. And so because of that, people don't like to hear the term change management. They don't like to hear about change. They don't want to talk about it because it didn't work last time. In those spots, you don't have that environment of trust, so it's going to be much tougher than an environment where either nothing's happened or the last change was good and there is trust. And that's that front-loading piece that I mentioned. the earlier you start with the change process of including people for a connection to the end state, so including people for their talent or their knowledge or their ability to be discerning about how this is going to roll out, any kind of connection like that that you do early on, you'll be able to include later. And if you have a change management person kind of in the middle, mediating the whole thing, you're taking information from stakeholders, you're feeding it to leaders, you're giving leaders the opportunity to integrate it into the change process, and then as the change person, you can communicate that right back to the people who deliver the information. And the best way to build trust in an organization is to take ideas and use them, and also acknowledge that this idea might not fit in because of this and give reasons, but show that you are listening, you're paying attention. And if it does make sense for that end state goal or for the process to get there, then it will be included. So it's those little teeny things that you keep adding in that end up building trust if the leaders really are committed to what they're doing and the people that are implementing understand how important it is to continue to describe what that looks like at the end.
Okay. You keep talking about stakeholders, and I'm wondering if there's a if you're talking generally about all employees, or how do you decide who are the key stakeholders to something like this?
Yeah, so everybody that's involved is a stakeholder in general. So the generic term stakeholder means everybody. And then there'll be levels of participation, accountability, responsibility as you go along, depending on where you are in the timeline. So I start early on dividing people up into stakeholder groups, or at least stakeholders that would have the same description of the end state, so they would understand it in the same way. They'll be motivated for the same reasons. But then those groups can somehow and sometimes change as the timeline goes along, because they stop working on one thing and they move to another thing, and some people are specialists, so they work cross-functionally a lot. And then there's the group that's the stakeholders, the executive stakeholders. And I actually have had a couple clients who thought that the executives were stakeholders and everybody else was an employee. So they didn't even tag the employees as stakeholders, which completely disconnects the employees from the whole process, which is part of this end state thing, is everybody's a stakeholder, even the executives. So
right.
For your audience that thinks of how do I do change from the middle with no real buy-in and no real money and no real influence and no real leverage, and I don't really know if I have the owners and the leaders on board, it's important to acknowledge that the leaders and the executives and the owners of this change are also stakeholders who probably will have behavioral changes, who will have their own description of the end state, who also need to go through that process of figuring out what this will look like at the end and how that might change things for them personally as a result.
Right.
So everybody's a stakeholder. There's groups of stakeholders, and it's important to acknowledge that executives are also stakeholders.
You said this something interesting to me. You said you split people into – split stakeholders into different groups based on their perception or their point of view towards the end state or how they're going to experience it. That just seemed like a new way of thinking to me, thinking about how grouping people into the way that they're going to see the end state. So the end state, it sounds like, is the same, but from different points of view. Maybe you could explain more what that means. Have different perspectives of the end state.
Yeah, I think what happens with most approaches and just the way we tend to operate when we're busy doing things is that we connect to all the work that we need to do to get there. And so we spend a lot of time with a chronological linear process that doesn't connect into any kind of bigger picture. We get kind of immersed in all the tasks and the steps to get somewhere. And we don't look at what it'll be like at the end and how things will be different at the end. And we don't set up a pattern of kind of getting ready for that. So building whatever skills we need to build on the way, acknowledging the changes that are taking place at an individual level on the way to get there. I don't know if that describes that anymore, but there's a subtle difference between being positive and looking towards the end and being goal-oriented and kind of naturally collaborating because it ties into that versus trying to change what you have now into something different. And a great example is a startup. When people get into a startup, they pretty much know where they're going, and they know exactly how they connect, because there's no extra people. Everybody has a specific job, but it's a team working on the same goal, and they just fly to change. It's all positive. It's all tied into the end. It's all tied into the spot they want to get to. And few changes within bigger organizations work that way, mostly because there's such a strong present status quo that is obviously different from the change, or you wouldn't be putting the change in. That's usually the core of big transformational change, is that what we have now is really not working.
Right. So it sounds like you're building some sort of awareness of, yes, we're going towards this end state, but that end state might look different for someone who's in IT versus in HR versus an executive versus someone who's on the front line.
Yeah, and it may be different levels of changing what's current to what's new. So for some, obviously for the parts of the organization that are used to change and that like things to move forward and that are super action-oriented, the description might be shorter, because it might not be that big a deal if they have to change their tools or change the way they do things a little, or the structure gets tweaked, or maybe they report to somebody else because they're more interested in moving forward to this thing. Whereas other groups, their day-to-day work process may change so much that it's a completely different kind of description. It may really be the kind where there's going to be resistance, where it's really hard to show why this is better for them at an individual level. And they may be the type of group of stakeholders who really could care less about this bigger picture. They could really care less about this excitement of coming to this thing that we don't even know about. And so they will need a different kind of change management than the front runners.
Mm-hmm.
And so dividing up in groups somehow sometimes makes that easier to come up with those descriptions, and probably spend more time on the groups that will feel affected the most at an individual level.
Well, you talked about this a little bit already, but since this show is for people who are trying to influence change without having that authority, you know, they're responsible for change, but they don't have the authority necessarily to get it done. How do you use this technique, or how can you use this technique from that kind of a position?
I think the biggest thing is early on, as soon as you know that there will be some sort of a change, so an idea popped up and the idea got turned into something that will require change, to start making those connections to people that are tied into both the process and what it looks like at the end of this change, and pull in their expertise and their knowledge and their skills and illustrate how that ties into the thing you're moving towards. So you're acknowledging people for what they think they're good at and know they're good at. You're including them in that description of the end state, and you're starting to build trust. In the middle of the organization, when you don't have a whole lot of leverage, you're building trust probably around the process of change, so that they know there's somebody there who understands how everybody will be involved. But if you go back to the stakeholder definition and you say, well, the executives are also stakeholders, is there any way that I can make some of those connections early on and get their individual level connection and then illustrate that to others? So you may not have the ownership and the buy-in from the leaders, but if you're including them as stakeholders and they do a few things to show visibility early on, you're effectively doing what a change management person does when they come in late. That's a great comparison. If you're middle of the organization, you'll need to do what the change management person who was brought in smack dab in the middle of the project is trying to do.
So if an executive or another manager in the organization is sort of handing it to them, like, we've decided we're going to go this place, here, you implement it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So the quick version of figuring out what the implementation is what's this look like at the end? What does that mean? What do we need? Who's going to be there? What has to be included in this end state? How much of that do we have now? Are we going to have to fill some in? And how much does that leader understand this? So the person who passed it off to you, or maybe the next level up, do they really understand what this means? And can I do anything to make a connection there to help build trust, to help elevate my role and my visibility as the person who's supposed to implement this, and to make connections from the leader and the owner to the individual stakeholders to help them feel more comfortable about participating.
Mm-hmm. And keeping that executive involved in the whole process and not letting it get dumped on you.
Right, yeah, as much as possible. And there's ways to include them without them having to run out in front of the pack cheering and rah-rahing about the change. If you include them as a stakeholder just like everybody else, they'll appear to be part of the change initiative even though you were the one who got told to implement it. Most change works that way anyway. There's an owner, and it usually quickly gets passed to implementation owner, who isn't responsible for the budget, but is responsible for getting it done.
Okay, so I guess, well, we're almost out of time here. So where can listeners learn more about your approach and about your organization?
I have a blog, horizontalchange.com is one spot, and then my company site, visiontowork.com. And on my blog, I actually have a blog role on the left-hand side. There's three or four consultants in there who have different versions. They probably don't use the same terms as I do, but it's a group of us that talks a lot about a different kind of approach that's more positive, more goal-oriented, more looking toward the future, and more building as opposed to fighting resistance, trying to tweak the status quo, and assuming that change is probably not going to be very successful. So that's okay. A help on the left-hand side there. And then there's a great site called 12manage.com that's a huge list of a whole bunch of different theories around business and management and change that'll give you a broad range of at least historical and current models. I think my approach is starting to be more common now, and versions of the way that I'm thinking are more common now, but there's really not any books out there yet that support it, and there's not too many papers that support it.
Okay. Well, thank you for all those resources. And Garrett, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here. I enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, thank you, Heather.
Thank you. So next month in June, tune in on Tuesday, June 21st. My guest will be Faith Fuqua Purvis of Synergetic Solutions. And the name of our show is going to be Revolution of One, Finding the Courage to Drive Positive Change. And I am excited to hear what she has to say about courage and where does that come from and what does it mean to be a revolution of one. In the meantime, if you would like to find additional resources and to see how we might work together to influence change in your organization, please visit www.enclaria.com. Thank you so much for listening to The Change Agent's Dilemma. Take care and best wishes for your change initiative.
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be.
Happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be.
Happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty! Yeah.